Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Wandering Road podcast. I'm your host Chris, alongside my co-host Dean, and for today's show, we're going to be covering Native American folk creatures. But before we get started with today's show, if you would like to have your stories and paranormal encounters with cryptids, aliens, demons, whatever the hell you might have encountered that's creepy or scary, please feel free to email us at twroadpodcast@gmail.com. And if you would like to be on the show and share your story with us on an episode, please let us know. Again, the email address is twroadpodcast@gmail.com, and we look forward to hearing from you guys. And with that, we'll start today's show. How are you doing today, buddy?
I'm a little cold today. I'm a little cold. You know why? Because I'm missing something from my face.
The Civil War beard is gone.
The Civil War beard. It hath retired. My wife and I flipped a coin. I wanted to keep it because it was about a year and a half of growth, and it was the longest beard I've ever had to date in my entire life. And it was, I'll admit, it was getting scraggly, but it was actually really cool, like, to kind of play with and just have. And, you know, like, after we flipped a coin and I lost, I shaved my face. My face felt so weird. Like, I could feel the air passing over my mouth and my lips. And for the, like, 2 days after that, I kept wanting to, like, reach for my beard and, like, grab it. Like, I used to do this. I know the listeners can't see it, but I would, like, grab my chin and wrap my fingers around my beard and just kind of twist it down. And it was such a fun thing to do, and I can't do it anymore. So I miss it, man. I don't know. I might come back soon, but we'll see. Anyway, I'm fine. How about you?
I'm good. How did your daughter take it? Was she afraid of you?
No, and we recorded it too. I didn't think my daughter would cry. I thought it was a small chance, but like, she didn't cry. Here's what we did. So my wife came downstairs with her after her nap, and I was like waiting outside the front door. I saw like on the monitor or whatever that they had come downstairs. Then I came through the door and my wife was recording, and my daughter just like looked at me like stupefied, not scared, but just like kind of smirking. Like she kind of knew, but at the same time, she wasn't sure. And she kept squinting her eyes like, is that daddy? Is that not daddy? By the way, she's like 2.5, so she can't really articulate fully about that feeling, but you could tell she was confused. And then after that, she's like, ah, it's daddy. And then she's like, and then we asked her, we were like, do you like daddy better with the beard or without the beard? And she's like, without the beard. So it's like, she likes it. So,
oh, you can never grow it back.
I know.
You can never grow it back. But all right, man, let's get into today's show. You were telling me you had an idea for an episode talking about some Native American folk creatures, specifically with the Wendigo and the Skinwalker. What have you got for us today?
Yeah, so I had this one in my back pocket for a while, and we've kind of, here's the thing with our podcast. If you've been listening to us for a while now, you know that we've been posting pretty frequently, like more frequently than a lot of podcasts that do. We usually put out an episode a week. And this is one of the ones that I had in my back pocket for a while. So I'll start with the Wendigo, and we can transition if we have time into the Skinwalker. And if you're not familiar with those two creatures or those two Native American lores, I think most people have probably heard of Skinwalker. I don't know, maybe some people, but not many people have heard of Wendigo. They're definitely in our culture in modern day, though, especially within the supernatural, like thriller kind of genre. And I'll say up front, I was going to work towards this part of the conversation, but I guess it's a good time to bring it up now. The reason why I wanted to talk about the Wendigo, because I've been thinking a lot about creepy shows that have been my favorite for a while now, and even a book that's not quite creepy, but it does reference the Wendigo. And the book, this is one of the first really complicated, not complicated, but like really adult books that I ever read when I was younger. It's called 3 Day Road. It's still to this day, even though I haven't read it in a while, one of my favorite books. And actually, Chris, you might even like it. It's from a Canadian writer named Joseph Boyden. I guess he has written some other stuff. So he's a really pretty well-established writer. And this book is rated really well for being out for so long. But this guy, to my understanding, he is part Native American, and he really wanted to dig deeply into his Native American side and also his ancestor side. So the story in a nutshell, and I'm probably going to butcher it because I don't have the synopsis fully in front of me right now, but it's about a couple Native Americans who get drafted for the First World War. And I think one or both of them, at least one of them, is a sniper. It goes back and forth between the two Native American men who go off to war and the either sister or wife or someone who gets left behind to kind of fend for herself. And keep in mind, if you're not familiar with history, like the First World War that took place in the very early 20th century. So what was it, Chris? It was like 1914 to 1919 or something like that. I think it was 14 to 19 or 14 to 18.
Yeah, it was July 28th, 1914 to November 11th, 1918.
Okay. Yeah. And if you're not familiar with that point in American history, it really wasn't all that advanced and great yet. We didn't even have a lot of the technical mechanical advancements that we had for processing large amounts of stuff. So there was some factory work, but probably not a lot. So if you were a Native American in that time and you were living in a small town, you were probably facing prejudice and also probably struggling to make money in this new economy that's burgeoning in America. So it's a really great book, and I'm sorry to get off track with it, but let me tie it back into the creepy side. There is a portion of the book that discusses the Wendigo. And essentially what I understand, it's essentially a malevolent creature that is also supernatural, but it's also very, even though it's supernatural, it's very much a physical being. It's almost like a zombie story in a sense, where the Wendigo is, in a lot of different stories, it's kind of focused on this characteristic of greed and cannibalism. And the story goes that the Wendigo, which is a very tall, mysterious, emaciated, pale figure, I think some people describe it as being like skin pulled over bones, jagged teeth. I think some people even report that it has horns, and essentially it hunts just to infect people and to bring terrible curses on them. And the thing though is, because like you notice I said cannibalism, so part of the story goes that if you engage in cannibalism, the Native Americans who did that in their tribes or whatever during the harsh winters because of starvation, sometimes they resorted to cannibalism, eating each other to stay alive. Then this hunger and this greed and this desire to be, this insatiable desire to get more and more human flesh would snowball. So in a sense, it's kind of like the quintessential zombie story where this one creature infects a human and then the human becomes that creature. However, even though it sounds very much like just lore, there are a lot of reports of actually seeing the creature over many, many hundreds of years. And it's worth mentioning, if you're not familiar with Native American history and lore, there were all kinds of tribes all over North America, even reaching up into Canada and down into Mexico, way before any visitors from European countries came. These kind of empires or tribes, so to speak, rose and fell, and they had different swaths of land. So it's interesting that the Wendigo is a story primarily from the northeastern territory of North America. So the Ojibwe, I think the Algonquin, maybe even the Sioux and the Crow might have had that story. But if you go further south,
I think it originated from the Algonquin.
The Algonquin. Okay. Yeah. And a critical component of that story is that all of those tribes being that far north in Canada or what is present day Canada just absolutely can just be freezing temperature for months and months, little food, little hunting. And you can really understand and see how such a story could become more prevalent and grow in those territories because people did starve. Native American tribes, even though they knew how to live off the land, they lived in such a harsh environment that they still faced famine and death and destruction. So one thing I was hoping we can talk about, and I'm sorry, I'm going really deep, but chime in a second. The other thing I wanted to talk about here is I wonder if in a lot of these stories where humans come up with terrifying aspects of creatures or demons or whatever, if we don't in some way manifest them or create them ourselves from the initial point. So I always wonder, like, maybe in the worst case scenario for a lot of Native Americans who were suffering at that time in that location, maybe the resorting to cannibalism was seen as so dark that it manifested some creature from another plane of existence and kind of brought it into this realm, as opposed to the creature just being plopped into our existence and causing all this strife. So I guess let's start there real quick. What do you think, in a broader perspective, is going on with this story? Do you think it's genuinely starting as from a creature popping into our existence, or do you think it's manifesting from the terrible stories and things that happened to those Native Americans in the freezing, frigid temperatures?
Real quick, when you described the Wendigo, it reminded me of the Deathclaw from Fallout.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like thin, hunched over, and it has horns.
Yeah,
I have a feeling that that creature was that the design for that creature was inspired by the Wendigo.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But that is a really good question that I've actually thought about in general when it comes to, you know, the paranormal, because humor me for a second. I personally believe that the human mind is very, very powerful. The human psyche is very, very powerful. And this might sound borderline tinfoil hat, but that's why, you know, we have this podcast, just to humor the idea. Would it be within the realm of possibility that certain things come into existence because we as a human collective will them into existence?
Yes.
Because let me put it this way, because I'm glad you brought that up, because I actually thought about this morning, because I was watching a YouTube video about it from the channel of the YouTube channel called Mysterious Middle East. It's a damn good channel that talks about Middle Eastern folklore and whatnot. And I was rewatching a video on the jinn. When you talk about jinn possession, jinn encounters, it seems to be localized to places that are predominantly dominated by the Islamic faith. When you talk about demonic possession with, let's use Pazuzu from The Exorcist, for example, you talk about all these different demons and the princes of hell and exorcisms, yada, yada, yada. It seems to be taking place in predominantly Christian nations. And then, like on our previous podcast, we did about weeping women. We talked about the Kuche Sakeona, right? The slit mouth woman. That's predominantly in Japan. You never hear of a Kuche Sakeona story happening in New York or Los Angeles or Miami, right?
Yeah.
So it makes you wonder, the collective psyche of human beings, just by the action of believing in it, allows it to exist within certain places across the world.
And to add on to that, what's even probably even more terrifying to me is it doesn't necessarily have to be a true manifestation of the creature or being or demon or whatever. It could just be, like you said, purely within our collective experience in our minds, even an individual's mind. So imagine that. I don't know. So not to go off on a tangent, but real quick, there's a side story. So I one of my favorite shows of all time is the Stargate SG-1 series. And it came out in like the late 90s, I think. There was one episode, the team and people at the base where the Stargate was were infected with some kind of, I think it was some kind of like alien creature or some kind of disease or something. And they would see these terrifying images in their field of vision, and then they would die. But they would scream before they died. They would scream like, no, no, get away. I'm being attacked. Well, you know, and then they would just drop dead. That's an example of something that could be happening with this manifestation. Like maybe we're not actually seeing things as people that are real. We're creating them with our minds, and we're allowing them to kill us or maim us or hurt us inside our minds. What do you think about that idea? That is it more so that we're creating it in our minds that might be a shared collective experience, like mentally, and then we're just being affected by it metaphysically and like through our body physiologically? Or do you think that these things are actually being pulled from the ether because of the strength of our imagination, and they become real as a free floating entity that can then affect us afterwards? Or does it always need us to think about it?
I think that question is hard to answer because you have to subscribe to one notion or the other.
Yeah.
And to me, it could be one or the other, or it could be both.
Yeah.
Because these things could exist in a different dimension,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I think it's proven that there are multiple dimensions aside from our three-dimensional world, if I'm not talking out of my ass with that one.
No, I think math has proven that there are 31 theoretical dimensions or something like that. So, yeah.
See, given the example that I gave earlier, that specific things tend to, I don't want to say attack, but tend to affect, let's use that word, affect specific groups of people. Because I've never heard of the Wendigo before until I encountered it as like a Native American story. I had no fucking idea of what that was. Through my background with my mom being Hispanic, I knew about La Llorona, El Bacá, El Cucuyo, all these different folktales from Hispanic culture, Dominican culture. I knew all about that, but I knew nothing about Wendigos. I knew nothing about skinwalkers until I actually decided to do a deep dive on Native American folklore.
Yeah,
I don't know if I'm answering your question or if I'm dancing around answering your question, because it's a difficult one. Because I don't want to be married to one answer. Personally, I think it has to be a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Because if you have a group of people, let's say for like the ancient Romans, they didn't, to my knowledge, they didn't fucking believe in a Wendigo. Mm-hmm. They don't have stories of a Wendigo.
Right.
But you have a civilization or a group of people that do believe in a Wendigo, and they have encounters with the Wendigo. There are still people to this day in Native American communities that say they have encounters with Wendigo, or they've seen one. So what do you think? I'll flip the question back on you. What do you think?
I agree. I think that it could be the way to answer the question of whether or not it's one or the other, and arriving on the idea that it can be both could be just stages, right? So I can already tell this is kind of good. I'm trying not to make this a boring episode. It's kind of getting really technical, and I promise we won't stick on this technical analysis too long, but if it's stages, you think about the metaphysical portion of the world, and metaphysical is essentially above the physical reality, but there's still a connection to our physical realm. So if you think about, this is probably a bad example, but like if you think of a thought in your head, that thought is being heard and spoken simultaneously by you, but you're not actually hearing the words vibrate in your ear. You're not actually seeing the physical manifestation of the word in front of you reflected by light. It's kind of like in the ether, so to speak, but it's still part of your neuron system in your brain. So it's still kind of physical, but at the same time, like we don't understand our brain completely. Is it a superposition where our consciousness comes from another location and it's ethereal? Or is it really, truly, purely all physical? So I think of the same kind of idea projected onto this, like what we're talking about of how humans might manifest these terrible things that might become real. It could be stages. So think about it. Like you think of a word, right? You can picture the word in your mind's eye. You could see it in a way. You can hear yourself say it without actually speaking. So that is the first stage of manifestation. The second stage, or the stage beyond that, is you take an action to say the word. Or you take an action to write it down, and then you can then see it. Here's another crazier idea. This is fucking great, because this is like, look at where we're at with technology and robots and AI and shit. This is a perfect example. So we create artificial intelligence from the concept of our own mind, and we create supercomputers from the concept of our own mind. And then they're slowly marrying up to a point where they just completely surpass human capability. And you inject the idea that you can have that theoretical idea transition into a physical thing in our reality that is uploaded into, say, a physical robot that also, by the way, which we create, that was a concept that is now physical. All of those manifestations in our head, which is, you know, arguably the first stage, are injected into something physical that can then fucking kill us. You know what I mean? And it's right, by that point, we have no control over it. We manifested that shit from ourselves, created it, and we will, hopefully that's not how things play out, but that's what people are worried about with like robots and AI. But isn't that interesting? Like this is why I love having this podcast, because I would have never thought to make that connection while we're talking, unless we had something to discuss this platform. So how about that, man? Like that's pretty profound to have that concept of like robots and manifesting demons and stuff. Like it could be one or the other, or both, or stages.
Or it could be like Butters in Imagination Land. where he just he just imagined shit to be true, and then they pop up.
Yeah.
No, but seriously, you have to take into consideration that the belief in something may have an effect on whether it exists or not. Mm-hmm. And I was watching a documentary, I think it was on Netflix, but it was with, I think it was Morgan Freeman, and it was about life and death and prayer and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And he went to a prayer session, and I guess they got permission, the film crew got permission to analyze these people. I don't know if they put stuff on their heads and whatnot to analyze their brain while they're praying. Mm-hmm. And there was actual change in their brain waves. Now imagine that with a million people believing in the same thing at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. I've heard of that before. It's kind of like a sinking on a, like a molecular or subatomic level or something like that, to where everyone's brain waves kind of get into this chant like equilibrium. And
right.
And see, that's the thing too, is like, when I was younger, I would see those signs like prayer changes things. And it was always from like the Christian perspective, because that's where I grew up in America, surrounded by Christianity and whatnot. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's what I always found interesting, is like, yeah, it's possible that prayer changes things, but that doesn't necessarily have to come from a source of some kind of religious deity or separate entity that's making things happen, like listening to us. Think about that. That's another thing we could talk about. And I know we're getting way off track, but this is something I want to talk about in a future podcast at some point, because it's not so much supernatural, but kind of like talking about theoretical philosophy and science and how we perceive the universe from a different scientific perspective. Just because someone has a certain religion doesn't necessarily mean that that religion is the source of their prayers being answered. Like we talk about with the manifestation of things, it could very well be that we do have a certain level of power that we're not aware of. And that power is not flowing directly from some being in the sky or some, you know, ultimate being of the universe hearing us and responding. It could just be that we focus on something we want changed so much that some energy being passed through us or from us onto the real world is lining things up so they happen in a way that's conducive to what we want, if that makes sense. And then the last thing I'll say is the way to kind of check that is think about like free will versus not free will. So many other reverberations across other people's lives would have to be changed, altered, or shifted in order for that thing to happen. And that thing being injected into our reality from an external source like God would disrupt free will. Because as soon as you have a God injecting into this reality to do something or change something to make a prayer come true, that will of God is being placed on someone who supposedly has free will, and that kind of negates the idea of free will. So I have to wonder I'm not saying there's not a God. I'm just saying it could be that a God created the situation where that God doesn't reach into our reality to change things. It just created a situation in which we can materialize things that we want by thinking about them and praying on them and focusing on them. So sorry, man, I went down. That's just like me going down another rabbit hole, but I just had to get that out, because I really want to talk about that in depth at some other point.
Oh yeah, definitely. But let's get back to the Wendigo.
The Wendigo.
Yeah.
I just made that sound. That's fucking stupid. Sorry, man. I don't know.
Have you ever heard of the tale of Swift Runner?
No. Swift, what is that?
So this took place in the late 1800s, so about like 1878, 1879-ish. Okay. So Swift Runner was a member of the Cree tribe in Canada. The dude was a skilled trapper. So for those of you that don't know what a trapper is essentially a fancy way of saying a hunter that catches things and sells them, yada, yada, yada. He was a skilled trapper. He was a respected family man. But during that time, there was a harsh winter, and him and his family faced the prospect of starvation. What was crazy in this story, this actually happened. This is a documented story. At the end of the story, the dude was hung and buried. They lived in close proximity to a trading post where they could go and get food. But for some reason, he just decided that he was going to kill and cannibalize his wife and five children. Hmm. And when he was arrested and put on trial, he claimed that a Wendigo spirit had possessed him, driving him to commit the horrifying act. And throughout all of this, he adamantly claimed that a Wendigo was responsible for this, that a Wendigo came in, possessed him, and forced him to kill his wife and children and eat them, which is absolutely fucking insane.
Yeah, that's a really sad story. And I, it's kind of a story that you hope isn't true, but you just know that some shit like that had to have happened at some point or another. And there's all kinds of crazy, terrible stories that have happened that we've heard of that you kind of don't want to be true. But I hear that story and I have to wonder, how far away from civilized society or organized society did he live as a trapper? I don't really know a lot about trappers in general, especially during that time period, but you know, it sounds like they kind of lived out in the boons, so there wasn't probably not a lot of education floating around for the kids. Probably not a lot.
He lived close to Fort Saskatchewan.
Okay.
So he lived close to the fort. Yeah, in Canada. He lived close to the fort and he lived close to the trading post. So when they say that, you assume it was in some sort of walking distance where they could go get food. And he was, let's see, when was he put on trial? His trial started in August of 1879, and he was hung in 1879.
That's more recent than I imagined that story being. 1879 isn't exactly too terribly long ago.
No, December 20th of 1879 is when he was hung, and they buried him outside of the fort.
Is there any inclination that anybody might have believed his story? I'm sure Native Americans who might have heard that could have potentially felt sorry or believed that story, but he was going before a legal system in which there was no basis or argument for such a supernatural thing happening. See, that's the crazy, creepy thing about stories like this is, you know, based off of years of history, hundreds, maybe a thousand years of history, Native Americans, this story growing and altering and whatever, and the creature kind of manifesting and being reported over that time period. As you get closer to modern day, when larger swaths of the population are being taken over by people who don't believe or know about such a story, the people who live on the fringes are way more susceptible, because not only do they not know about it, that thing is still floating around there and they're not expecting it. They're not careful about it. They don't know what's going to happen if they encounter it and how to deal with it. So he might have even been more susceptible to the creature, you know, telling him, getting him to act in such a way to devour his family. I would be interested to find out what his characteristics were like and his personality was like after that event. Like, was he still infected? Was he still creepy? Did he still desire human flesh and crave it and ask for it? Or was he back to normal?
So according to the reports, to the story, he kind of just acted normal. And basically, when they searched his property and found human bones and whatnot, he was like, yeah, that's my wife. He just said, like, openly admitted it. And it was not until he got put on trial and stuff. I'm sorry, not when he was put on trial, but when the investigations and whatnot started, that was when he made the claim that it was a Wendigo spirit. Mm-hmm. And the judge and jury didn't view the idea of the Wendigo in the same light as the Cree. So what you said has some credence there, that some of his tribe would have believed him. But the rest of the people, which I assume were not a Native American by this time in 1879, they viewed him as a murderer. They were kind of baffled that he made no attempt to hide his guilt. Mm-hmm. He didn't deny it. He just said, a Wendigo made me do it. Kind of like that Conjuring movie, The Devil Made Me Do It. That famous case, which took place in the 80s. I think it was the 80s, where the guy like killed his employer or whatever at that dog kennel. And he said, well, I don't remember doing it. So their defense of it was the devil made me do it. So right. In this case, it's the Wendigo made me do it. But they didn't buy it and they hung his ass and they got rid of him. And what's interesting in this situation is that they said he was fond of kids, a little too fond of kids. So that was another accusation laid at him.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So This is one of the stories where it's like, I don't think it was a Wendigo. I think this just guy was just a sick bastard.
I was trying not to go down that road because we always go down that road. but we have to go down that road because that is a very important road.
Yeah.
I agree with you, man. Now that the cat's out of the bag, I agree with you. I think that that's just a really sad story of someone probably having some mental issues who might have been stressed about the time and the finances that they were under, or whatever. But still, at the same time, you can't possibly, there could be something more there, because you think about what it would take for someone to have five children with a woman. Now, I mean, if it'd be one thing if he had one or two kids and then he snapped, like, you know, it's possible that maybe a guy like that just couldn't handle being a father. He didn't love his wife anymore, and he wanted to just get them out of his life and then just move on, and came up with a story when he got caught. However, he had five children. But then again, you also say, like, oh, there really wasn't contraceptive back there. So maybe he was just a maniac who loved sex. And then they just kept having kids. And then he eventually snapped because he had so many kids and so much stress and stuff like that. But that's still, that doesn't really help the situation or alleviate the severity of it. It's still a really dark story. So, I mean, at least that's something that can always be looked at from different perspectives. But the fact that he lost his mind in a way could be indicative of a spirit or an entity. It doesn't have to be a Wendigo, some kind of spiritual supernatural influence. Then, as we know, some people just have, like, what do we say about that? You know, all the stories about people going to their religious leaders if they have some kind of issue with needing,
like, an exorcism or something like
exorcism,
that.
Exorcism. They say, what do they say? They always say either go talk to a psychiatrist.
Go talk to a psychiatrist.
Yeah, go see a psychiatrist.
Go to a doctor. You go to a medical professional.
Yes.
But let's humor this situation.
Yeah.
So let's say it was actually a Wendigo. One thing I would want to know is, with what you described from the Wendigo, did he actually turn into one and then just carried out these acts, and he was only able to view it while the Wendigo was in control, if that makes sense? He was kind of like taking a back seat,
right,
while all of this was happening. And it's like, fuck, I can't deny it because I saw everything. And it's like, yeah, Wendigo took me over.
You know what I can see in that situation happening? I think that, yeah, that's kind of touching on, if it were a Wendigo, how it would play out. But I think that you can go even more in interesting detail. Here's a possible answer to why this happened and how you can conceive of somebody possibly sliding down a slope to doing this. I don't think that a Wendigo just came up to him or found him and just turned him, and he just, I don't know the story, but I'm guessing he didn't snap completely and kill all of his family at once and then start eating them all over the course of a month or whatever. My guess is that he had a sick child and they had a shortage of food, and he, maybe with or without the blessing of his wife, either ended the life of the sick child or the child died, and he managed to convince his wife to cook up and eat the child if they had some kind of food shortage. That's how I can see that playing out. But with the integration of the Wendigo, that's the crazy thing about the story of this creature, is once the individual gets a taste for human flesh, or even anything that's like avarice or greed or anything that really drives them to want more and more, it's just a snowball effect of seeking and always, like, not being able to turn down that drive or desire. So it's, and that's actually true. I think there is some scientific evidence to point to the idea that if someone consumes human flesh, there is some kind of physiological thing happening in your body and your brain once it's processing that meat. And to tell you the truth, man, I actually get something sometimes where, like, if I eat a big red steak, and I like my steak medium rare, if I eat a big red steak, sometimes I'll have, like, night sweats, and I'll have, like, stress dreams, and I'm not able to sleep, and I'll have this really sensitive reaction to eating red meat. I think I said that before, but that's interesting. That's just beef. That's not even human. So maybe there's something even deeper that's happening in a physiological level when someone consumes human flesh. The interactions with your body breaking down the flesh that you are mostly made of, the DNA or whatever, there might be some kind of issue with your vagus nerve or your gut biome or something that's affecting your brain that really could drive you crazy. So imagine that the Wendigo bleeds over from that terrible experience you know, maybe of consuming his child and the guilt from it. The Wendigo detects that terrible situation and just gets him to want more and more and more flesh. And the only solution is to kill more and more of his family to a point where he has no one left. And then someone comes and checks on them or finds them. And then the Wendigo leaves. That is the crux, the end of the story that makes me think that there could be something supernatural going on here, is that what do we see when someone is possessed? After the terrible situation ends and there's no indication that the person has any mental issues left over, then the person returns to normal. So right. That would be interesting right. to find out in Native American lore, if that's what happens usually with the Wendigo. Does it infect you, make you eat a bunch of people, go crazy, and then once you get caught, it just bails and jumps ship on you and you're fucked.
Right. So are you saying in the potential act, because we don't know if they actually did that, in the hypothetical act of consuming one of his children, that opens the door to welcome in a Wendigo spirit.
Yeah.
That would make sense to me. There were three other Wendigo encounters I found. There was one called the Fort Kent Wendigo encounter, and this happened in Fort Kent, Maine. This took place in the late 1800s. People in the fort reported encountering a terrifying creature resembling the Wendigo. And another trapper described the creature as a gaunt, emaciated figure with unnaturally long limbs and a foul stench. The trapper said that while he was out, it seemed like the creature was stalking him, and he said that he narrowly escaped with his life. Another story that I found took place in the 20th century, early 20th century, by the Rousseau River. This person claimed to have an encounter with the Wendigo-like creature while he was hunting in the forest. He described a tall, skeletal figure with antlers and glowing eyes. The creature let out an eerie, echoing cry before running off and disappearing into the woods. Another encounter, which happened in the northern United States to a group of hikers, they reported a harrowing experience while exploring a remote cave system. They claimed to have seen a shadowy figure lurking in the depths of the cave resembling the Wendigo. The creature was described as emaciated with elongated limbs and glowing eyes. The hikers fled the cave in fear like a bunch of little bitches instead of investigating further. But again, it's that same description from different people in different time periods.
I'll just highlight one thing across the two stories. So there's two stories you talked about where there are multiple people reporting the same thing. And whenever I hear a story like that, like something supernatural or something outside the norm of what we normally experience as people, as human beings, and it's being seen or experienced by a group of people, I always have to wonder, like, is there a possible scenario where they ingest something hallucinogenic and it's kind of a shared experience? That's where my mind automatically goes. But
so are you saying all these people in the fort got high and saw the same thing?
Maybe, but it could have been by accident, you know, not intentional. It's just kind of baseline for me. It's not something that I believe is the fact. I just have to wonder. That seems more probable to me than a creature like that. So when I think of the Wendigo, the story of the Wendigo, I don't think of it as a creature that would present itself to a lot of people at once. Maybe I don't know shit. Maybe it could be. That's still a creepy story because you're stuck between this idea that it doesn't match up the typical traits and the story of the Wendigo, but it also is a larger group of people reporting some kind of creature or monster or something like that. Is there any, in either of those two stories, are there any hints or reflections of those people having greed or avarice or even having a taste for human flesh?
No, it sounds like these people were just going about their business hunting. Out of the three stories, two of them were hunters that seemed to be hunting on their own in the woods. And the other encounter is with a group of hikers in the United States. And with a group of hikers, I'm assuming this has to be fairly recent.
Yeah, that's true. It's possible they came in contact with some other creature, but it's interesting that they went to the Wendigo. See, that's another interesting thing. If you encountered something that wasn't tied to, like, a big component of the Wendigo story is cannibalism. If there's no other component to that story involving cannibalism, why did their minds go to Wendigo first? Then maybe they already had that in their minds as a way to explain what they saw, but that doesn't mean what they saw was what they were waiting or anticipating to see. Could have been a Sasquatch, could have been some other creature, could have been Mothman for all we know. There's the throwback for you.
Fucking Mothman with always, the red eyes.
It's always the Mothman. It's always the Mothman.
That bastard.
There's one more story that I wanted to touch on, and we went really in depth with the Wendigo, but I think there's another.
Yeah, I think we beat that horse enough.
We beat that antlered, emaciated creature who just won't die. And now I have a craving. No, I'm just kidding. Let's move on to skinwalkers. Skinwalkers, I think, are more well-known in American culture today than the Wendigo. But the skinwalker is, to me, is a little bit creepier because the skinwalker isn't like the story of the Wendigo. There's some similarities, but the main difference that I can see from my research is that I think the belief is a skinwalker starts out as a human being who has some kind of hunger for power. They are either a witch or a wizard or whatever the proper term is for that type of person in Native American culture. And they go to try to create this power by doing evil, like harnessing evil forces in the world. And then they kind of snowball and become this very evil entity. However, the quintessential trait for the skinwalker is that they can shapeshift. So, and they can even shift into any animal that they want or human being. And all they have to do is put some skin on from that creature, which is terrifying because if they have to become a person, they got to put the skin of someone on their body. That's a horror movie waiting to happen.
I think my mean cat might be a skinwalker.
Your mean cat?
Yeah.
That's a long time to lay low though. I don't know, man. Oh,
she's just biding her time.
This is a fun side story, but my wife and I, like when we were like really poor college students, we lived in this old house. It was really an apartment. It was a house, but we lived on one floor and we lived with like two other people. And one of the other people had a cat, and this cat would talk. I'm not fucking kidding, man. We would be in her room sleeping.
No. What would it say?
Oh God. What? Oh, that's what it said. So once
the Mothman.
Okay, well, I'm not, I swear to you, whoever's listening, I am not fucking kidding. There's no exaggeration here. My wife and I were in her bed, or my girlfriend at the time, my wife now, my girlfriend at the time, we were in her bed and we were getting ready to sleep. This is the first time this happened. It was dark. It was quiet. We lived off a side street in like a suburb of Pittsburgh. So there wasn't really a lot going on. Just imagine, you know, we're falling asleep. It's just black. Quiet, dark in the room. It's an old house. It's a little creepy. So her closet door was ajar, and that wasn't anything different. It was always ajar, whatever. It's kind of a messy room. No big deal. So we're falling asleep and we hear some scratching. And we're like, oh, okay, what is that? Why is there scratching? Is that coming from outside? And then I sit up to like listen. And as soon as I sit up, I hear this like frantic, just like crashing and like thrashing around in the closet, just bouncing and just everything hitting off of everything and just going nuts. The door is rattling. And I sit up and I am terrified. Like, we're both terrified. We're like, we're about to die. That we're like two seconds of realization. In that 2 seconds, where our immediate thought is terrified, we're going to die. And then like the third second and beyond, we realized the fucking cat was in the closet that freaked out at me sitting up in the bed. And the cat's not allowed in the room. the cat would be able to reach up and open the door with its paw and push the door open. And I guess what happened was it pushed the door open, got into the room, got into the closet. We didn't know it was in there. And then we shut the door at nighttime to go to bed. And then the cat freaked out and just like running around the room. But here's the best part about the story. After that, from that point on, he started talking at our door because he wanted to get back in. He was just lonely. I don't think he was an evil cat. But we would be lying in bed getting ready to fall asleep. And then we would hear this. Hello? 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 And it would sound like he was fucking saying hello, like he wanted in. And it's still creepy to this day. I think he just learned how to mimic human talk, but that's also kind of creepy in a way. But there you go. There's your kind of mini Skinwalker possible story, which, by the way, I think that cat's still alive with our old roommate.
That's creepy.
Have you
ever
heard a cat?
Sounds like a haunted cat.
Have you ever heard a cat do anything like that? Your cats or anything, like make noises?
No.
No.
There's the evil cat right there.
There he is.
You, listeners, you can't see her, but she's right there.
That's the
cute. She's a calico.
Cat,
calicos are fucking evil.
But it looks
they
so cute.
Are evil.
It looks so innocent.
She is. She's freaking adorable, and she loves me, and she hates my wife, who actually was the one that adopted her. But no, none of my cats talk. So I think you encountered maybe a skinwalker.
Probably.
And you survived.
Can I ask you a side story about cats, though? This is just a really, really stupid side rabbit hole. But so I used to say that I hated cats when I was younger, but that wasn't really true. I just didn't have an affinity for them. And now I don't hate them at all. I think some cats are awesome and cute and playful. But I still prefer the company of dogs, I guess. There you go. I just lost half of our listener. No, I'm just kidding. So my question
all
for you,
all five people,
all five of them, down to two and a half. So have you ever heard the concept or the scientific argument that cats could have some kind of, is it like a parasite or something in their brain, in their feces or whatever that could be passed on to a human being? To
pregnant
them,
women?
I don't know about, yeah, that's another one. That's another one where they're dangerous. I know that cat feces is actually dangerous for children in some ways. What I was getting at is some people are starting to wonder if cats have, not intentionally, like not that they created this, it's just part of their body. Like, I think there's something in cats, like a parasite that lives in a cat, and it can get into a rat or a mouse. And then the parasite infects the rat or the mouse to like the smell of the cat. Like, people wonder, is it possible if the parasite has an effect on humans? Because a lot of people who are cat people, they are like cat people for life, and they worship their cats. And there's like this kind of borderline pseudo conspiracy that cats really do have this parasite infecting people, even like intentionally or unintentionally, probably unintentionally. But
so our cat's going to take over the world.
Yeah, that's like,
is that what you're trying to get at?
I think unintentionally, maybe, but they're like kind of like, think back to the time of the Egyptians, like they were obsessed with cats. I don't know. That's just kind of, have you ever heard of that before, by the way?
Yeah, I have. Okay. And I can honestly say that has not affected me because okay. My cats are fucking assholes.
And you know, I can leave you outside in a heartbeat.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't do that to them. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I've heard that concept before. More so that it could be harmful to like their feces can, their, I guess, whatever odor or something radiates can be harmful to pregnant women. Back to the skinwalkers. Yes. So they can shapeshift. They can take animal forms. What else do you know about the skinwalkers?
So I know that they came from and they exist mostly within the southwestern tribes or territories of America. And
yes, that is correct.
Oh, is it? Which one was it again? Does it say?
They are, it's particularly with the Navajo, the Hopi, and the Pueblos.
Navajo, Hopi, and Pueblos. Okay.
Yes, yeah. And they have similar beliefs of the entities.
So I kind of...
But they have different names.
Oh, they have different names.
It's, yeah, I unfortunately, I don't have them on hand. But the same concept applies that they can shapeshift. They have animal forms. They have malevolent intentions.
Mm-hmm.
So skinwalkers are often associated with evil deeds, such as causing harm to other people, spreading fear, seeking revenge.
Yes.
They could use their powers for theft and other harmful activities. What's really interesting, when I did research on the skinwalkers too, in my research about skinwalkers, I also saw that like you're supposed to avoid eye contact with them.
Mm.
Because the Navajo and the Hopi, they believe that if you make direct contact with eye contact with a skinwalker, you could provoke them or reveal their true identity. So it's recommended that you don't. And that the ability to essentially the transformation to become a skinwalker is essentially achieved through forbidden practices that often involve dark rituals or witchcraft, and they may include acts of extreme evil or the betrayal of one's community. So it's essentially, if you want to be a skinwalker, it's like you got to go and shank like 15 babies or some crazy shit like that. I'm exaggerating. I know. I'm exaggerating.
Oh man.
Yeah. But like committing like an ultimate betrayal, like, you know, like killing your mom or sacrificing someone.
Yeah.
It's insane. Yeah. I feel like skinwalkers scare me more than the Wendigo, because if you scroll through TikTok and you get to the paranormal side of TikTok, people have video of alleged skinwalkers.
Yeah.
There was this one video, I don't know if it was like a police officer or something. It was like on their body cam or something like that. That like this, I may be flip-flopping it. It's either someone ran into the bushes and then like a second later an animal ran out, or there was like an animal and then like a second later it like turned into a person.
Yeah.
It's really, really fucking crazy.
Huh.
And there was one of like a horse or something. Someone was riding a horse and I forget what happened, but something like really spooked it. And people in the comments are like, oh shit, that's a skinwalker. Mm. The animal knew, like, I guess it was like a person or something. Mm. And when they got close to it, for some reason, the horse just randomly got scared of that person and just fucking bolted back the other direction. And everyone in the comments is like, oh shit, that person was a skinwalker.
That's another thing that I remember you just brought up in my mind about the skinwalker stories in Native American culture. So it's not just, and I apologize, I don't think you said this yet, but I know you said like you're not supposed to look in their eyes because it might draw attention and
reveal their identity or something. Yeah.
And then they'll, you know, draw their ire and they'll want to attack you for revealing them. But it's also interesting that this is a particular story that Native Americans who are part of the culture that hold on to these stories, they don't even like to talk about them. They don't like to mention them because they actually, some of them believe that it will draw attention to them. Like if there's some kind of like some sort of divining rod or something like that, like if you talk about it, it'll know from a distance or get a sense about it. So that's probably why we don't have so many stories about skinwalkers, because they probably happen mostly within the confines of the location, like on the grounds or the land that the Native Americans originated, which goes back to the concept that we were talking about earlier with like manifestation. You know, we don't hear people talking about skinwalkers and the idea of shapeshifters from the context of Native American skinwalker ideas in modern society in like downtown New York. But you did just say that there are things like experiences where people have recorded and claimed to see shapeshifting people and animals and stuff like that. Now, I want to say that I don't believe, I would be more in the camp of not believing that there's an actual shapeshifting going on. I don't think that like the material that's made up of a person could transition suddenly into the material of a cat or a wolf or something like that, and then have it actually be a physical wolf that loses all of the DNA attributes of a human being. I think that if there was such a thing to happen, it would have to be some kind of either technology to create some hallucination or mass hallucination, or just make it seem like that person changed into something. And that's another crossover too, which is interesting. If you ever heard of Skinwalker Ranch, there were a bunch of documentaries that focused on the Navajo Skinwalker Ranch. And that was mostly about UFOs though. So there was some bleed over there about possible injections of technology funny enough, here's another Stargate episode that popped into my head. There was some race of alien in one of the episodes that had the ability to touch someone, and when they touched the person they were talking to, not only would the person forget what that creature looked like, it was completely non-human, looked like an alien, but when the alien touched the person, it injected not only the memory of that person as a human being, but it also showed like it, the person who was looking at them, that on that alien, the alien looked like a human being. So I wonder if that's some kind of technology going on or some kind of infection.
Sound like a bunch of space perverts to me.
I know, right? They could do anything. And the only thing better would be to be invisible. Walk into a space locker. That's where all the aliens are.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up Skinwalker Ranch, because I feel like in all of the stories for Skinwalker Ranch, it's more so talking about, like you said, UFOs. They talk about poltergeist activity. Hmm. They talk about glowing orbs. They talk about fucking Bigfoot. So I don't know. It seems to me it has nothing to do with skinwalkers.
Yeah. Sorry, everyone. You just completely derailed the original. Like, but there's one more thing before we run out of time that I wanted to bring up about skinwalkers, because I think this let's go back to something fun. This is another plug, of which I have no, I'm not going to get paid for it anyway. But this is a great show, and a great,
which we should.
I wish, yeah. If we, if we got paid for anything like this, it'd be like two checks for like $20. But it's still worth it because it's still a great show and it's a great book. So the book is the original, obviously. It was written in 2018 by none other than Stephen King, which, by the way, holy shit, I got to say this real quick. So when my wife and I went to California, it was my first time in California. We went there like a year and a half ago, maybe, or maybe 2 years ago now. It was a blast. Like I loved like going around LA and trying all the food. I would probably never live there unless I made a lot of money, which I don't. Or not enough, I mean. But LA is super expensive, but it's also super fun for a short trip. But after LA, we went up to Mammoth Lakes Park. And Mammoth Lakes Park, if you've never been there, it's gorgeous. Like, I love Mammoth Lakes. It's like unbelievable beauty in a natural landscape, really wide open, but there was still like, you know, civilization. You can go get a good bite to eat or some good coffee, stay at a decent hotel that's kind of like a log cabin style thing. So when we were up there, we stayed in this nice, kind of nice-ish hotel that looked like a log cabin. And we were outside in the pool hanging out. It was still warm. You know, Mammoth Lakes can get pretty cold, but it was still summertime, so it was pretty warm. So we're out in the pool and we were just playing around with my daughter. And I swear to God, I saw a guy on the other end of the pool who was laying out with a woman, I think his wife. He looked exactly like Stephen King. And I made eye contact with him a few times. And I'm like looking at him. He's looking at me and I'm looking at him. And I'm like, if that's not Stephen King, that is his fucking stunt double. Because this dude looked just like Stephen King. And Stephen King looks very unique. There's not a lot of people that I've ever seen who look like Stephen King. He's a very unique looking guy. So I didn't have the guts or the balls to walk up and be like, hey, are you Stephen King? Because if he wasn't Stephen King, then he probably gets that shit all the time and he didn't want to deal with that. And if he was Stephen King, he was on vacation and he didn't want to be bothered. So I kind of just kept my mouth shut. And to this day, I wonder if it was him. So anyway, Stephen King wrote this book called The Outsider. Now, The Outsider, if you've never heard of it, is a horror novel, traditional, and it's essentially about this murder that's happening at a time, like it's an unspeakable crime that's happening, I think, to a child at a time when a stranger shows up into a town. And then it's obvious, you know, like the question for the town does the stranger have something to do with it? Who created this grisly murder? Who did this grisly murder of a child? And then it slowly unravels to find out that there's like a supernatural component and an actual creature that's floating around that has an effect on things around it. I don't want to ruin too much, but it's also not just a book. It's a TV series with Jason Bateman. So you can go watch it. It's on, I think it's on HBO Max and Hulu. But the creature is similar to me, like the skinwalker. It's actually the reference is kind of different. It's El Cucho or El Cuco, which I think you know more about than I do because it's part of the Latin American culture. It has shape-shifting properties. And here's the last thing I wanted to talk about after going through all that rigmarole. Sorry for everyone to be long-winded again. But what I'll tie it back to is here is a very clear tie between Native American older history of a story of something that, you know, shifts shapes and is a creature and is malevolent and it has it out for humanity. And the El Cucho, which is similar, but it's kind of like different in a way. It's a mythical ghost-like monster or boogeyman or whatever. However, it's still the same. It's a shapeshifter. It's got glowing eyes. It's malevolent. So whenever we talk about things like this, I always have to wonder about the crossover and the stories. Because like you were saying earlier, Chris, you were saying that it's interesting how people conceive of these different stories and they don't bleed over. But here's one that bleeds over. So the last thing I'll ask you before we go too long, what do you know about El Cucho? And if you know anything about it, apologize if I'm asking, I'm kind of throwing you in the ring, assuming you know something more about it. But how would you tie that back into, say, a skinwalker? Are there any similarities? And have you heard any stories about the El Cuco when you were growing up?
So in Spanish, they call it there are multiple ways to say it, but it's mainly El Cucuy. Mm-hmm. And essentially what it is, it's a boogeyman. It's not really anything like a skinwalker or anything like that. It's mainly used as a boogeyman for kids that don't want to behave. And they essentially, what it does, it's kind of like, I want to say like the equivalent of Krampus. Essentially,
I was just thinking,
which
that.
we will do episode dedicated to Krampus.
Please, closer
to
Christmas.
The holiday.
Yes,
we will. But essentially what El Cucuy does is like it kidnaps like children that don't listen to their parents. Whereas a skinwalker, they essentially exist to do evil things. They kill people. They steal shit. And another thing that I found out, another reason why you're not supposed to look at them in the eyes and make eye contact is because if you do, there is a possibility that they can take control over you to do their evil bidding.
Right.
So they don't have to do those evil acts. Do them for them.
I wonder what the motivation for such a creature would be, though. If they're not part of the human race, what would they
need? No, that's the thing. They are.
Oh, they are.
They're people that do this black magic witchcraft ritual to get the power to become a skinwalker.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah. So it's not necessarily that a skinwalker just exists.
Yes.
It's more so you have to become a skinwalker.
That reminds me of a quick story about an Indonesian similar kind of idea where, so in Indonesian culture, when I was traveling there, I was told to watch out for these, God, I don't even know what the Indonesian, Bahasa and Indonesian name is, but imagine these white children size creatures. So these creatures, I don't think I talked about this yet. These creatures, they look like children. I shouldn't say they look like children. They're the size of children, but they're very clearly not human. They're humanoid. They have two arms, two legs. They have huge bulging eyes. I think they almost look like aliens, but they don't have quite that proportion that aliens do. They still have ears and orifices and noses and stuff, but they're all, when I say white, I'm not talking about Caucasian. I'm talking about like, they are literal, like a fucking blizzard white. They have no genitals. They have no nipples. I don't know if they even have a buttocks, like a crack. They just have like nothing about them. It's all like just whitewash. There's no contours other than their face, their ears, and their nose, and their like general form. They don't wear clothes, and they're probably about like the size of, I want to say, an adolescent, like maybe 3.5 feet, maybe 4 feet tall. They're not huge. They're not very big at all. They're not like teenager size. But apparently the story that I heard is that witches and wizards, or whatever the proper term is, in Indonesia, which by the way, those people exist for sure. I've met them. I've met people in which we could do a whole episode on this at some point, like shaman. We should do that too. So we got the Krampus we'll do at one point, and we'll do like from not necessarily just the spiritual side, but we'll focus on the people who conjure the spiritual side. So maybe we could do an episode on the shamans and stuff. So I actually have met shamans in Indonesia, and they're fascinating people. Luckily, my friend took me to shamans who believe in good. They identified as Muslim, so they believe in God and they believe in good stuff, but they were focused on white magic and white power. There are, however, for sure, individuals in Indonesia who practice black magic, just like there are people who practice black magic all over the globe. Supposedly, the people who practice black magic are able to conjure these little white creatures who are for the most part benign. I guess it's not that great of a creepy story because they're not really dangerous from what I hear. They just go out and steal shit. And the person that I met who dealt with them directly when they were a kid said they looked out their back window when they were a kid into this field, and they saw like three or four white, these little white creatures roaming around, and they didn't know what they were. And the next morning they asked their parents, you know, I saw these things outside at nighttime. I think they were kids. And then their parents went like dead cold, like just completely like white face. They just, all the pigment ran out of their face. They just got so scared. And they explained to that person I was talking to when they were a kid, you know, don't ever talk about it again. You have to let us know if you see it again. And from what I understand, these creatures aren't necessarily harmful. They just go out and steal things for the people who conjure them. So that's kind of like in a similar vein where you're talking about some spiritual or supernatural, or not supernatural, but like a human being who wants to conjure the supernatural for malevolent or evil purposes, like stealing or killing or maiming. So I think that I believe such a thing is, I know for a fact those people are out there. I know for a fact people go and play with those things and they try to do those things. What I don't know is if it actually has any manifestation in real life. What do you think about that? I know you know too that there are evil people out there, people who are trying to reach into the evil side. Do you think that people succeed in doing that? And if so, how hard is it to do that? How hard is it to become a skinwalker?
I think that, so I'll answer your first question about people doing evil stuff like that. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely 100%. Because judging by how fucking shitty the world is, I think a lot of people are succeeding. But on the serious front, I think it's easier to conjure black magic or evil magic. And I'm not a magician, so I don't know. I'm just kind of speculating. I think it's easier because there are so many like rituals and stuff involved with magic in order to do it correctly, that if you don't do it correctly, it can conjure up something that you weren't expecting. So by that in itself, I think it gives credence to the idea that there's more black magic than there is white magic. And on top of that, human beings in general, we're all fucking assholes if you think about it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that I am.
No, you are. A lot, you're a huge asshole.
Yeah, I'm a huge fucking dick.
I'm just
I force you to be on this podcast. You're such a nice blackmailing guy. You.
No, I love you, man.
I try to be.
He's a nice guy, everyone.
In theory. But if you think about it, most human beings, we just care for ourselves, right?
Yeah.
But on top of that, if you think about human beings in general, most of us care for ourselves. And there are some people that will go to a fucking extreme to get what they want, whether it be money, another person, material items. On a podcast called The Confessionals, hosted by Tony Merkel. It's a great fucking podcast. I was a guest on that like a couple years ago. Great guy, great show. If you ever get a chance to check it out in general, I completely recommend it. But there was someone on there that was essentially a magician that dabbled in black magic and made the claim that they used it for money. Like they would do these spells for money and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So like he would conjure up these spells and follow the instructions to a T. And then at the end of the next, he would wake up the next day and there'd be like fucking, like $1,000 sitting in the middle of his room. And he would do this shit every night to the point where he had to hide the money from his parents. So like people wouldn't start questioning it. I don't know. Maybe he was dealing drugs. Who the fuck knows? But in all honesty, stories like that, yeah, there are people that do that shit. Then you look at all these documentaries and whatnot of people that practice the dark side of voodoo and do all of these dark side of like magic and whatnot. So I think that's definitely within the realm of possibility.
Yeah. The other crazy thing about that concept too is imagine if you didn't come from that background of believing in something so powerful that even if you knew that it was dark, you didn't, like you and I are sitting here. Okay. So you and I have had some strange things happen in our personal lives, right? But we've never had anything crazy to the point that it completely shapes or alters our version of reality or how we perceive things. So like you've had some crazy stories. You've seen some crazy things. You've seen beds lived off the ground. You've seen stuff like that. But what I'm talking about is people who grew up.
Not beds lived off the ground, but like people thrown.
People thrown.
Same vein of concept.
Yeah, my bad. I guess I'm thinking of another story from somebody else. But yeah, it's the same vein. So we've had, like, I've seen 25, 30 foot pine trees shake and then something fall out of it at a speed that I can't track with my eyes and run across. I have no idea what, to this day, what that was.
A Wendigo.
Could have been. Hopefully not, because that guy Phil I ate, he was not really that good. I don't know, man. I'm just kidding. Fuck that. I'm just kidding. I've never eaten human flesh. Don't come after me for that. But seriously, though, like you and I have had some weird things happen. We've seen lights in the sky. We had stuff following us. We blah, blah, blah. However, there are people out there who I've talked to, you've talked to, who have had some really heavy shit happen to them. So in those cases, I wonder if you have someone like you and I, which seems like more prevalent than not, because like we live in a world, we live in society in modern age where like people don't talk about the things that we talk about. They don't talk about things that people experience. They just kind of dismiss it in general as crazy, not really anything to throw a lot of consideration at. However, imagine being someone like you and me who is desperate, who kind of had some dabbling or heard some stories about this sort of thing, but just jumped right in to the deep end and tried really hard to conjure something evil or dark. It didn't matter. It does, or not even dark. Could be maybe you're trying to conjure something that you think is good, but you really want something. You really want that $1 million. You really want that new house. You really want that beautiful woman or man or whatever. But then you get caught in this cycle of thinking what you're doing is actually having an effect. But then imagine you do something, like you do a ritual, like you cut a chicken's throat and you bleed it out over some pentagram or some weird shit, which, by the way, we'll talk about pentagrams later, but I don't think, anyway. So like, whatever. So, and then something happens that you wanted to happen. What would people feel? I feel like most people would give up. Most people would be like, oh fuck, this actually worked and this is real. And I shouldn't be playing with this shit anymore. And then people just go right. Get silent. A subsection of humanity, I think, that tries this shit, sees that it works. And maybe it's possible that the dark side will make it work for those people that the dark side knows that they're more susceptible and more malleable and open to influence. So if you're someone who's automatically open to that, to sticking to the dark side and helping out the dark side, maybe you're more likely to experience or get the things that you wanted to get, but you're not looking at the whole fact of, you know, you got to pay for it later. So that's what really blows my mind when I think about like evil shamans or evil witches. They must know deep down, like, or Satan worshipers, right? Like let's say, I'm not saying I believe for sure that the Judeo-Christian reality is true, but let's say it is hypothetically for a second. If you're a devil worshiper and you know about the Bible and you know God is the source of all things and the creator, and you know in the Bible it says in Revelation that God will come down and judge people in a fire or whatever, and God will win over evil. Even if you're winning in that moment and you know that fact, you must know that you will be on the losing side eventually, yet you still do it. So that's what really blows. If there are witches, if there is a dark side, if there is a malevolent side to humanity that people are exploiting, how in the holy hell could you justify doing that, knowing that you're going to be on the losing side? That's what I never understood about evil witches and wizards and stories like that. What's your perspective, man?
I think that some people just don't care. Mm-hmm. They just care about the here and now.
Short-sighted. Yeah.
Very, very short-sighted. It doesn't matter to them, you know? Of what happens afterward, it's kind of like, I'll just take it by a case by case basis.
Yeah.
But for me and you, you know, we experience these weird fucking things. And then it's like, okay, there's an aspect to this that is real. Like you said before, for every 9 cases that are made up, there's one that's real. And the fact that that one or that 10% is real is really fucking terrifying, because we did a 1 out of 10 example. That's 10%. You do that to a million. 10% of a million. That's a lot.
Yeah.
10% of 100 million. 10% of 500 million. 10% of how many people are there in the world? Seven point eight billion.
Yeah.
8 billion. 10% of 8 billion. Fathom that for a second. You going to do the math?
Oh, no. What is that? That's like, I think that's 800 million.
So that's 800 million experiences that people have had. Are all those people making that shit up? Are all of them fucking crazy?
Right. That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of fucking people to call crazy. A lot of people going about their daily lives, whether it's a Wendigo encounter, whether it's a Skinwalker encounter, some sort of demonic possession, djinn possession, whatever. Pick your fucking flavor, because there's a zillion of them. For all of them to be lying and crazy, there has to be some sort of fucking truth to this stuff. Because if you think about it, for centuries, we've had these stories from Native American tribes that go across different tribes. Different fucking tribe. They didn't have the fucking Pony Express. They didn't have fucking iPhones. If you wanted to talk to another person from another tribe, you were walking at least 50 fucking miles, 20 miles. Do you know how fucking long that takes?
Yeah. Oh man.
Or going by canoe. Like, do people not realize how long that fucking takes? How the mode of transportation in the past, even 200 fucking years ago, how difficult that was.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, okay, they're just bullshitting over. Like, no, to me, there has to be some credence of that stuff. Because if I didn't fucking know you at all, and I made my way from Western Pennsylvania, I walked across the fucking U.S. and took a boat to Hawaii and met you for the first time, and you told me that you experienced, we never talked before, you just tell me the same exact experience without me sharing that shit with you that I experienced. Did he make it up?
Right.
Like what? Like where do we draw the line?
Yeah.
Is where I'm getting at.
Yeah.
When it comes to saying this shit is made up, because there has to be some truth to it. I'm sorry, I went off on a tangent there.
No, man, that was great shit. That was a great soundbite. I totally agree with you. I think that. Well, I would slightly disagree on the proportion of humanity. I think that like you could still do the same math and say that there is a large amount of human beings, especially throughout history, because we talk about today there being 8 billion people alive. But I think in the entire, well, I can't do the math right now off the top of my head, but I think that the entire human civilization has been around for, or not been around since, but the total amount of humans who have ever existed on this planet that we know of is like 19 billion. Wait, hold on. I gotta look this up real quick, people. Sorry, hold on.
It's 117 billion.
Okay, thank you, man. Okay, so yeah, there's no way it was even a trillion. But that's crazy, man. 117 billion people, which means 10% of that population, and you're talking about over a billion, well over almost 2 billion people in a 10% bracket. Even if you drop that down to say, you know, a tenth of 1% of all of humanity has a completely unexplainable encounter with the metaphysical or the spiritual, I'm sure it's higher than that. But if you talk about people who truly experience something that there's no explanation for, that's still a shit ton of people. I don't even know the math off the top of my head. That's probably like 100 million some people.
So if we take 117 billion and do 10%, I think that's 11.7 billion people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yep.
So even a tenth of a percent, you're still talking about hundreds of millions of people. So I think in that perspective, I agree that there's something strange going on in our universe, in our own realm on this earth. But my question after accepting that fact, that point, not necessarily fact, but accepting that point, is that if there's something going on, and it seems there is, then whatever other side or spiritual or metaphysical or whatever realm you want to talk about, dimensional, whatever inhabits that has to be intelligent. Because if you're talking about a spirit or a deity that is selectively choosing when to cross over into our plane of existence and to manipulate or affix itself to someone in this plane who will listen to it, there's got to be a multidimensional awareness of that thing, not only from its own dimension, but into our third dimension. So that to me is way more terrifying than the actual act of the thing occupying our third dimension and making things happen that are malevolent or evil. It's that they know who to target. They understand every aspect and level of us, of who to target. And they know what to do to manipulate us so we become more receptive to them. That is fucking bonkers. And that is, I can see now why someone who is really religious would want to believe in a good deity or a good God or whatever, because that is the only way to balance that terrifying idea that something malevolent would want to come after us and know how to come after us.
And what's even crazier, dude, is what you just said, the belief in something, you know, benevolent to combat the malevolent. There are fucking people out there, and you know who you are, what sects of Christianity, that don't fucking believe in demons. They don't fucking believe in demons. How the fuck are you going to believe in all good and not accepting the concept that the negative aspect of that exists?
Dude, don't preach. Don't preach. We're going to lose listeners.
I will digress from that. I will digress because it fucking boggles my mind.
I will
say, and to even tie it to this podcast,
yeah,
that they'll be like, well, this, they're just making it up. So you're telling me people over 300 fucking years, maybe even longer, are just making this shit up for fun, making this shit up for fun.
Here.
Maybe some of them are. Maybe some. I will concede.
Okay.
Because like you said before, people like to make shit up just to make this shit up to be included.
Yeah.
I will concede that point. But for the people that are genuine and honest about it, I don't understand. But I digress.
That's a great point, man. And I can totally resonate with that concept, or that concept resonates with me rather. But I think back to what we just talked about with JJ from the Southern Demonology, like that, the podcast he did, like when we talked to him, he brought things up that I didn't know that I found fascinating. And one of the things that ties back into that is talking about Zoroastrianism and the original concept of like a good energy in the universe and a bad energy in the universe and how they're constantly in conflict with each other. But when he was talking about the original Jewish concept of God, he was saying how the original belief structure was such a way that they didn't have demons. They didn't have a devil. They didn't have a hell per se. Everything flowed from God. So when I hear that as that being the original concept of spirituality on this plane of existence, this human race or whatever, modern humans, I have to wonder, is it possible that whatever being or beings that are above us, that they're not truly all benevolent, like our idea of a one true Judeo-Christian, all good God, and there's just evil things that exist in the world that are against that one true good God? I have to wonder if it's possible that whatever reality is the highest level of reality that we live in, that it's coming from a not totally benevolent source. So that, I guess we've been on for such a long time. This is a great episode, man. I love it. What do you think about that last concept of the possibility that we might be living in a reality where there is no truly all good? There is no truly all bad. There might just be people manifesting like the Wendigo by eating other people and creating this terrible scenario among humans, or these wannabe skinwalkers who conjure what they believe are evil, malevolent spirits to help them get power, when in reality, it's not good or evil. It's like a lion killing a gazelle. Death is bad, but the gazelle needs to die for the lion to live. And from that source, drawing from the metaphysical side of the total reality we live in, is it truly all good versus all bad? Or is it a mix of both coming from the same source? What's your thought?
I think there are things that are truly good and truly bad. I think when you give the example of the lion and the gazelle, that's just the food chain. That's just the nature of the animals. One is a carnivore, one is a herbivore. When it comes to humans and the concept of the Wendigo and cannibalism, that is a conscious choice. Whereas to me, certain animals, while they might be self-aware, most of them act on instinct. And with human beings, we have the luxury of not doing that. Unless you're like doing sports or something like that. If you're out on the soccer field and a ball is coming at you, you're just acting on instinct. You're not thinking, oh, I'm going to take the ball and then I'm going to hit it with my side foot so it goes in the top of the net. No, I'm going to stick my foot out and to make sure I get the ball on target. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
When it comes to something complex as the Skinwalker and the Wendigo, with the Wendigo, it's a little different because that in itself seems to be of a cryptid type of supernatural creature. When it comes to the Skinwalker, it seems as if it's a person that is making the choice to become this paranormal type of entity.
Agreed.
That is where, you know, your will, human free will, and your consciousness comes into effect. Whereas with the story of the guy that we shared earlier that killed his family, if you believe his story, it was the Wendigo that affected him. Because according to his community, he was a loving father. He was a great trapper. He loved his kids. He loved his wife. And for something like that to happen, was completely out of the ordinary. So there we could maybe give the Wendigo some sort of credit of influencing that situation. But when it comes to a Skinwalker, this person wanted to become a Skinwalker. They had to commit some sort of heinous act. And the whole purpose of them existing as a Skinwalker is to basically do foul deeds to benefit themselves or benefit whoever is calling upon them. And also, folks, just remember, rag on the hag.
Rag on that hag, man.
Thanks for tuning into today's episode of The Wandering Road. You can find us on Apple, Google, Spotify, and most podcast platforms. Be sure to subscribe and share. Also, don't forget to give a follow on Instagram at TW Road Podcast and follow my TikTok at TWR Podcast. Take care, and I'll catch you on the next one.